Assistant Attorney General Kleinmeier to begin his oral argument, and he will now begin it.
Okay, this is Stephen Kleinmeier from the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff appellate petitioner. The case is on review of a decision of the Court of Appeals which affirmed the trial court's order suppressing evidence. The court suppressed on the ground the police had made an illegal no-knock entry in violation of the Fourth Amendment. The case arises out of a search of the residence of Orton Ruiz on February 10, 1997, which is again before the decision of Richards versus Wisconsin, in which the police found marijuana and cocaine, and the circuit court granted the motions to suppress because of the no-knock entry. This is another case where in the trial court, the prosecutor conceded that the police would not be able to satisfy the criteria of Richards versus Wisconsin in order to justify the entry. So they conceded a violation of the Fourth Amendment. There are not many facts in this case as far as how this occurred. But the issues then concern, okay, given that there's been a violation of the Fourth Amendment, what is the remedy? What should happen to the evidence? And there are three issues on that. The first being that, the question being, if the police violate the Fourth Amendment by failing to comply with the rule of announcement, should the evidence be suppressed when there's no causal relationship between the illegal police conduct and the seizure of the evidence? And the other two issues, if the court decides in favor of the state on that issue, then the evidence is admitted, we don't go on to the next two. The other two issues concern good faith, that being if the exclusionary rule is otherwise applicable, should the good faith exception be applied here when the police made a no-knock entry that was authorized by the court's blanket rule in State versus Stevens and State versus Richards, and also whether apply the good faith exception because the search warrant itself authorized the no-knock entry. Now, on these issues, it's the state's position, these issues only arise under the Fourth Amendment. In Ruiz, in his suppression motion, he clearly relied solely on the Fourth Amendment in Richards versus Wisconsin. In Orta's suppression motion, she made a general motion alleging the search was unreasonable, citing the Wisconsin as well as the U.S. Constitution, and explaining a specific objection to the search. She's cited only the Fourth Amendment in Richards versus Wisconsin to argue that the no-knock entry was a constitutional violation. When it got to the point where she was arguing the remedy, then she started relying on Hoyer and other Wisconsin cases for applying the exclusionary rule. But as to whether the entry itself violated was unconstitutional, she relied solely on the Fourth Amendment. In this case, the police had an affidavit which listed some established that Orton Ruiz were drug dealers by showing an informant had purchased drugs there previously, had seen other purchases made at the residence, said the drugs were stored in the bedroom, and said in his experience, search warrants often find firearms, knives, and other weapons. The warrant was issued authorizing a no-knock entry. On the actual entry, there are very few facts. It's simply that the police got to the residence, entered, the state conceded it was a no-knock entry, and then they found marijuana, cocaine, and some other evidence. The trial court on the suppression motion granted a suppression motion, but reluctantly saying they found the police acted in good faith under the blanket rule in Stevens and Richards, but said because no good faith exception had been exclusion rule had been adopted by this court yet, he was forced to suppress the evidence, so he did so. Although he was critical of the suppression, but he granted it. The Court of Appeals treated this as a Fourth Amendment case only. It's the only insight, I think, even cited the Wisconsin Constitution as to whether the no-knock entry violated a constitutional right. They did discuss Hoyer when it came to the good faith exception, but not as to whether the entry was a violation. So that's another indication, I think, that this case is just a Fourth Amendment issue on the Fourth Amendment challenge. It's the state's position, first of all, that as to whether the evidence should be excluded, that it should not be suppressed because of the Fourth Amendment violation unless the unlawful police conduct was a cause of the discovery of the evidence. Here, the unlawful police conduct was a failure to announce before entering, failure to comply with the rule of announcement. One of the steps, at least, was not complied with. But it's the state's position that the failure to comply with the rule of announcement, especially if otherwise valid search warrant, is not a cause of the evidence being seized. The evidence is Whether the police announce or not, if they announce, they certainly have, they would go in, they'd discover the evidence. So by not announcing, it's the same thing as if they announce.
Yes. Let me ask you about that. In this particular case, does the record reflect something that would justify the position you're taking? In other words, what is there in the record that would show that had they announced, there would not have been time for the occupants of the home to dispose of the drugs that were later found?
Okay, well, the Fourth Amendment doesn't protect that. In Segura and in Kerr versus California, Segura the majority, Kerr versus California, the plurality who wrote the opinion, so the Constitution doesn't protect the right to destroy evidence. And so that's whether they would have had whether the occupants would have had a chance to destroy evidence is not relevant to the legal issue about whether there's a causal connection.
Well, when you're arguing inevitable discovery, are you not tying that to the facts and circumstances of the particular case?
But the defendant's not allowed to rely on the fact he would have discovered evidence. In Segura was a case where the police illegally entered the defendant's apartment, occupied it for 19 hours while they went and got a search warrant. They came back with the search warrant, executed the search warrant. The Supreme Court held that even though the first entry was illegal, the evidence seized under the search warrant was admissible. The dissent said, wait a minute. If the police hadn't been in the place for 19 hours, the defendants could have removed the evidence or destroyed it. The majority said, addressed that and said, that doesn't matter. We're not going to protect the right to destroy evidence. That's just the fact that they would have a chance to destroy the evidence is not relevant to any legal analysis under the Fourth Amendment. So, I mean, whether it's a practical matter they would have destroyed it, is a legal matter that can't be taken into account when you're discussing whether the failure to announce was a cause or not a cause of the police being able to discover the evidence.
I think that the question, though, raises another one, is what is the relationship between the inevitable discovery and the causal issue? Are they the same analysis?
No. I think causal is even more basic than inevitable discovery. In Nixon versus Williams, where the court applied inevitable discovery, that was the case where the police were there was already a manhunt for the little girl's body. The defendant told them what the body was in violation of Sixth Amendment rights. He wanted it suppressed. The court said no, because it would have been discovered anyway. And in the analysis, they say, looking for the exclusionary rule, the first question is whether the violation was a cause of the seizure of the evidence. But then you go beyond that. Now, in Nixon versus Williams, the defendant's statement about where the girl was a cause, was a connection between finding the evidence. And they still found that it was admissible because it would have been discovered under the other search anyway. In this case, we don't even reach the first step of Nixon versus Williams because there is just no causal connection between the failure to announce and the discovery of the evidence. Under there's a case that I cited in the court in a letter, it was cited July 20th, that's People versus Stevens from Michigan, where that Supreme Court they relied mainly on the inevitable discovery to say that the evidence seized when there's a failure to comply with the rule of announcement is still admissible. Saying they said the Supreme Court has found you have to have a causal connection. Either there is no causal connection between the failure to announce and discover the evidence, so we're not going to suppress the evidence.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if you should prevail, it seems to me that we would be nullifying Richards versus Wisconsin in just about all respects. Because any time the police have a search warrant, then they could forego the rule of announcement. And once they get in, for maybe very legitimate reasons, maybe they believe, we don't believe, but they believe that any time you're dealing with drug dealers, you've got a dangerous situation. But maybe the U.S. Supreme Court said that's not true. So assuming that that's the state of the law right now, what would prevent a police officer, if we go along with you, standing outside that door and saying, look, let's go in there anyway. Let's not announce, because whatever we find, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said is okay because there's no causal relationship between our failure to knock and announce and the discovery of this because we've already got a search warrant.
Well, in Segura and Nixon versus Williams, the court said there are other deterrents besides the exclusionary rule, citing civil remedies and police discipline. And a civil remedy, one is quite practical, I think. If you have an isolated case, where the Madison Police Department routinely complies with the rule of announcement. In one instance here and there, or an isolated case that an officer doesn't, there may not be a remedy for that. But as far as just a police department making a practice of ignoring the rule of announcement, I think this City of Canton, Ohio versus Harris, surely shows a discipline or a deterrent, because under that case, even the City of Madison, that we're here, could be held responsible for failing to train their police officers to comply with the constitutional rights of people's homes whose homes are being searched. And one of the ways to establish that, according to Justice O'Connor in her concurring opinion, a concurring and dissenting opinion, is if you fail to train on something where people are dealing with constitutional rights, and you fail to train where the city is aware of repeated violations. Now, if you could have the police constantly ignoring the rule of announcement, I think that there's going to be a very strong case that the municipality is going to be responsible. I think the municipality, that might be a stronger deterrent for the municipality and its police department. You're going to hit their pocketbook than losing evidence in some cases. But, I mean, the civil remedies are the basic deterrents there. And Nix versus Williams and Segura cited those. And it's not just my imagination. They cited civil remedies and police discipline as other ways to deter the police misconduct, in addition to exclusionary rules.
If I understood your response to a similar question I asked in the last case, not every case will protect the police if they go in on a knock without knocking.
Yeah,
in
my understanding of the civil areas, which is not real strong, is that probably not, because I think there's something that's, my understanding, something like a good faith exception, a good faith type of analysis built into the civil remedies, whereas if it's not a clear violation, then there's a good chance that there wouldn't be a recovery. But if you have repeated violations, I mean, I think you can understand that. In a specific case, for example, you may have a violation of rule of announcement where the police knock, announce, wait for a matter of time, and some court later finds they didn't wait long enough. So, I mean, it's kind of unclear sometimes with police.
Your position then, in many, if not most, in the majority of the cases, there's a causal relation. Therefore, if you don't knock, this is your question, I think, if you don't knock, the evidence will not be suppressed.
Right.
In a minority, small number of cases, gave us an example at the end of the last oral argument, there is a causal relation between failing to knock and the suppression. So that's why Justice Babbage has asked you, I think, in effect, Richards is gone, which is the same way I stated the question of swallowing up the no-knock.
No, I disagree completely, Your Honor, because okay. Richards established the Fourth Amendment right for a knock and announce.
Right.
That's the right. Now we're talking about the exclusionary rules, the remedy. The Supreme Court and this Court has said that the right and the exclusionary rule, the remedy, are two separate questions. One does not necessarily follow from the other. As the Supreme Court said in the no-knock case, in Ramirez, just because you have a violation, you still have to go out and analyze the cause. This is not really something new. I mean, this idea that a Fourth Amendment violation will go unpunished by the exclusionary rule is not new. I've cited some examples in the brief. One is a situation where the police execute a search warrant that's valid. They go beyond the scope of the warrant. They see some evidence that's validly within the scope of the warrant, some evidence beyond the scope of the warrant. This court says you admit the evidence that's seized within the scope, you don't admit the evidence seized beyond. So, but they're still admitting the evidence that was seized valid and invalidly. In the Conrad case, the sheriff came in and dug up holes, I don't know, a number of holes all over the guy's farm, some right next to his house out in the field. They found the body out in the field, so the court admitted the evidence. So he had no remedy for the violations within the curtilage. And the attenuation doctrine, I think, is even stronger from our point of view, because that's a case where there is a causal connection. You start out with one, but the evidence just is so far down the line or so far removed from the cause, even though some connection, it's still admitted. The inevitable discovery rule has been applied by this court. This is not really something that's unusual, something that's never been done before. I think it's the analysis that applies here.
Do I understand your argument to be this, in response to Justice Babbage's question? Justice Babbage essentially asked, isn't it correct that if we follow your argument, we're really avoiding or doing away with the Richards case? And your response was, not necessarily so, because there can be a civil action against a municipality if there is recognition of a concerted attempt by law enforcement to enter without announcing. Am I missing something?
Type of civil remedy. I mean, there are there could be civil remedies against individual officers. It might be hard to prove. Yeah. Again, these are not original ideas that I have come up with. These are all out of the U.S. Supreme Court.
I know. Okay, they may not be original. Are they good?
I think they're sufficient deterrence. As in Segura, the court said, we're not going to assume the police officer automatically going to violate the Constitution. So they wouldn't accept that assumption, which apparently is the assumption that has to be made if you're going to say that this is going to wipe out Richards versus Wisconsin. There were police officers who didn't make entries under the blanket rule when they had it available. They still applied under the old rule. So, I mean, police officers are not going to just, because the evidence will be excluded, ignore the rule of announcement.
Let me see if I can outline your argument. Richards is good law. You have a right to have the police knock.
Correct.
In an appropriate case, right? That the police didn't knock in this particular case. They should have. That does not necessarily mean that just because the right has been violated that you have a remedy of exclusion.
Right.
And you point to the open field case as an example, because the violation was of the curtilage, but you allow evidence from outside the curtilage,
right,
and et cetera. And then your argument is that it's not a invalid, that the right is not a superficial and meaningless, because there are remedies, and that would get you over the hurdle of the Wisconsin Constitution of having a right without a remedy.
Yes. Well, there's an assumption there that hasn't quite been connected yet, and that's about whether there is a right under the Wisconsin Constitution yet.
Right, but let's just do it broadly. And that your answer then is that you do have a remedy, and your remedy is, for one example, a civil suit.
Right.
That's
correct.
Your analysis as I hear it.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. And, I mean, as I say, relying on the U.S. Supreme Court, these are just statements made out of the Nixon-Segura cases where they say the remedy is, the civil remedies, the Michigan Supreme Court, in that case, in this People versus Stevens, in Michigan, they cited the statute that says, I think they cited the proposition that a police officer can be fined $1,000 in jail up to a year for violating constitutional rights, something is another deterrence in Michigan.
This is your second shot at this, and I'm still want to know what your argument is for adopting Leon.
Leon? Okay, the primary one is starting with the court's statement in Conrad, the two purposes of the exclusionary rule, where the court was applying the Wisconsin Constitution as well as the Fourth Amendment. The two purposes of the exclusionary rule are deterrence of the police misconduct and the protection of judicial integrity. So the courts are not involved in using the evidence as illegally seized. But the court also discussed, and now it's easy, I think, to see how Leon fits in with the deterrence part. If the police have it look like a valid warrant, they're not deterred from anything when they comply with that. As far as judicial integrity part of it, the court went on to say that's valid, but only when the exclusionary rule is accomplishing its purpose of deterring the misconduct. So there's a cost to pay from this exclusionary rule, because relevant and reliable evidence is being kept out. Now, that cost is worthwhile as long as the exclusionary rule is achieving its purpose of, preventing future misconduct, or at least deterring future misconduct. But when it can no longer do that, I mean, then my conclusion is, when it can no longer do that, the opposite is, when it can't achieve that purpose, then you lose the balance. and the cost outweigh the use of the exclusionary rule for the judicial integrity issue. And as far as the idea of the search and see, the Fourth Amendment in Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution, if that were implicated, but in this case, we're not talking about the Fourth Amendment, but to the extent that protects private right, the price of privacy, I mean, the right itself does. The exclusionary rule is not, as the court said in Conrad, the exclusionary rule itself doesn't, because if the police come in at the innocent person's home, the exclusionary rule is of no benefit, because there's no evidence to exclude. The exclusionary rule protects the innocent person. We go back to deterrence, only to the extent that it deters the police conduct generally. But when you have a situation where there's nothing to deter, I don't see any reason, there's no, under Leon, and it seems to me that it follows from Conrad, that there's no purpose in applying exclusionary rule. And I mean, there are some other reasons. I mean, on top of that, there's a whole idea of consistently applying the Wisconsin Constitution, if we get to that. But just under Leon and a Fourth Amendment analysis, I think that's the primary one. In fact, on a Fourth Amendment analysis, which I think is the only issue in this case of the Fourth Amendment, I don't think this court has any discretion. I think it has to apply Leon.
Okay.
And Illinois versus Kroll.
Suppose we disagree with you and that the Wisconsin Constitution is involved here. Okay? And then the court has two choices, at least. One, to say we're going to follow Leon, and then you're back where your argument is, and you don't care if we follow the state constitution or not, right? I mean, you don't care if it's in the case if we say they're both the same.
Right.
Right. Okay, so then let's suppose the court says they're not both the same. How does that follow, and what kind of issues arise then?
Well, again, I think the same reasons would apply I just gave, which we'd apply it for justifying in Leon, but justify here. There's just the only way to protect, basically, this judicial integrity is that's only valid as long as it's deterring it. In addition, you have this long history of applying the Wisconsin Constitution and the Fourth Amendment consistently on search and seizure issues. And this court has said, like in the Frye case, that consistency in itself is good policy. I think the wording of the two constitutional provisions are the same, which indicate that they would be applied the same. I think another part on the consistency part of the issue is, I think about the only way you can say that a violation of the rule of announcement is a violation of the Wisconsin Constitution is to say you're going to interpret the Wisconsin Constitution to follow along with Richards versus Wisconsin. I mean, in State versus Stevens, the issue was raised, and the court only said, well, it's a common law rule. You know, it didn't even get to the constitutional issue. So at this point, there's no holding that violation of the rule of announcement is a constitutional requirement under the Wisconsin Constitution. The court's going to adopt that to remain consistent with Richards and the Fourth Amendment. Then it would seem to me it follows that the remedy should be the same. I mean, if the right is going to follow under the Wisconsin Constitution is going to follow the Fourth Amendment, it's only logical to me that the remedy, whatever remedies are available in the Fourth Amendment, are also available in the Wisconsin Constitution and not additional remedies. I think there's, on the good faith part of it, if the court would otherwise find now that there's this causal relationship, otherwise apply the exclusionary rule, it's a question of whether to apply the good faith for the compliance, because the police comply with the blanket rule. The court said they act in good faith. It's an objective standard anyway. I think it'd be pretty clear. It's got to be clear that when you comply with the decisions of the state Supreme Court, you'd apply good faith. And I think under the Fourth Amendment, this court basically, I think, is required to apply a good faith analysis because under Illinois versus Kroll, and that was a legislative action, this is a court decision. But it seems to me that, if anything, the police are more entitled to rely on decisions of their state Supreme Court than the legislature when it comes to authorizing searches. So at least the Fourth Amendment is applied. I think that would require. There's been an argument raised, backing up again to the first issue about this causal connection, that that somehow taints the judicial integrity by using, illegal evidence as a result of a violation or is connected to a violation. But I think that answer is also answered in Nix versus Williams, where there is no violation of judicial integrity by a violation of the Fourth Amendment, where the police would have obtained it anyway. And again, that was in the inevitable discovery case, when at least there was arguably some causal connection between the violation and the evidence. Here, I don't think there's any connection, so even more so I think it applies that there is. Judicial integrity is not an issue when there's no causal connection between the violation and the seizure of the evidence.
What have the other states done, counsel?
In regard to
adopting the good faith.
Well, at least it's to this blanket rule thing. In North Dakota, has just recently had a series of decisions from the beginning early this year where they have applied the good faith exception when the police executed a no-knock in compliance with their previous blanket rule. And their previous blanket rule was adopted in Louts, L-O-U-C-K-S, which is one of the cases cited by this court at Stevens. I mean, I think that connection would help show that you'd apply the good faith here.
In other states?
Frankly, I'm not aware of exactly why they don't all comply or not comply. I know many of the courts that have refused to adopt a good faith exception under their state constitution cite their long history of interpreting their search and seizure provisions different from the Fourth Amendment. Well, I certainly don't think that applies here, where our long history is the opposite, which is a long history of being consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And when we're consistent with the Fourth Amendment, defining what the rights are of the Fourth Amendment, I think the remedy would be consistent too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. You will have 5 minutes rebuttal. Mr. Nielsen, representing Lisa Orta in Ricardo Ruiz.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Mark Nielsen. I'm from Racine. I'm an attorney. I was trial counsel for Ms. Orta, and today I will be speaking for both Ms. Orta and Mr. Reese. There's nothing new under the sun. 77 years ago, a lawyer from Racine stood up and argued before this court about the admissibility of a controlled substance that had been seized in an illegal search. Now, that lawyer was Jerry Foley, and the illegal substance was alcohol, and the name of the case was Hoyer. But in that case, they dealt with pretty much the same issues that we're dealing with here and a lot of the same concerns. In that case, your predecessors in the Wisconsin Supreme Court looked to our Wisconsin Constitution, engaged in an independent process of analysis. Yeah, they looked at federal cases, but they also looked at state cases. And when they got to that part of the decision, that last six pages, where they were saying, this is where we stand, this is what we think, they didn't cite any cases at all. They just engaged in reasoning. And what they reasoned from our Wisconsin Constitution was this, that Article 1, Section 11 states some guarantees. It guarantees freedom in our homes and possessions. And they read that to apply to the guilty in order to protect the innocent. They also read it to be prohibition. It's prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. And they read it as a prohibition applying against the state as a whole. Not just the policeman on the beat, but having equal applicability to the judge in his courtroom and the prosecutor in his prosecution. And they held that upholding the integrity of the constitutional process in this state is not just the job of a policeman or the responsibility of a policeman, it's the responsibility of the courts. Now, that's a decision that came down at the time when it was felt we were losing the war against crime, and we didn't have perhaps a war against drugs, but we had prohibition. And there were a lot of pressures on the court to deal with not drug dealers, but bootleggers. And in the times since Hoyer, there have been pressures on the court to deal with every random threat you can put a label on. Communists, unionists, student radicals, the mafia, you name it, and there's always some bad guy out there who are being told, well, just set aside or reinterpret this provision. We can get these guys. And that, I think, is what we are talking about in a whole series of cases that have been cited by the Attorney General and in the arguments here. Okay, Ms. Orta had 3.7 grams of cocaine in her house. 3.7 grams. Maybe that makes her unsympathetic somehow. But the fact of the matter is that in the discussions that you've been engaging in today for the last hour and a half, and that you'll engage in with me for the next however long, you're the Supreme Court. You're going to be stating down a rule that's going to apply to everybody. And if you come up with the rule that you think is right to apply to the drug dealers, I'd ask you to please remember, it applies to the nurses and the doctors and the lawyers and the innocent people too, because there's one rule for all. And apparently has to be, given the fate of the Richards decision. Now, the Attorney General has come up with an argument on no-knock cases, and in this case really is no-knock case, that essentially goes as follows. Unless the violation caused the evidence to be seized, then exclusion of the evidence is not the appropriate remedy. The problem with that argument is it proves way too much. There is no conceivable case. Indeed, I find the one instance suggested by the Attorney General to be strained.
Remind the court what that incident was.
I'm sorry?
Remind the court what that situation is that Mr. Kleinmeier gave at the end of the last case. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a federal case in which the police are coming with an arrest warrant, and they don't knock and announce. They instead break in. I believe they break into a garage, if I remember the facts of the case. A fellow inside the house becomes alarmed, and so he arms himself, and he goes to his garage, and fortunately nobody gets shot. But they come in. He's not the guy they're looking for. The guy they're looking for is a fugitive, and they think he might have been hiding him out, but he's not the guy. But they find out that this fellow has a felony record. So he's a felon in possession of a firearm, and they arrest him for it. Now, the state says that because he wouldn't have armed himself if they hadn't busted the window, and arguably he had some right to arm himself, then this is a case in which that gun was sort of the product of the no-knock entry. And I find that strained, frankly. But even conceding it, that's such a sui generis and bizarre set of facts that I think it simply demonstrates the truth that there truly would be no remedy whatsoever for rule of announcement violations if you take causation as the criteria for applying exclusion as a remedy. I believe it was Justice Wilcox asked about, couldn't they have maybe destroyed the evidence in the record? Indeed, as I read the brief of the state of Wisconsin here, what I would have to do at a suppression hearing at the trial court level would be to put my client on the stand and have the client testify something like this. I anticipated I might be hit with a search warrant. I installed an automated evidence destruction system, this red button here on the wall, and had they but knocked, I could have pressed the button and the evidence would have all been destroyed, leaving not a trace. And that guy, whose testimony would establish that he's planning to commit yet another crime, and to violate the very principles that the exceptions to the rule of announcement are supposed to prevent, that guy would be the only one who would ever get the benefit of suppression in a rule of announcement case. And that doesn't make any sense to me. There is no rule of announcement if you don't have a sanction for violating. And the Attorney General's suggestion, consider for a moment, Fourth Amendment jurisprudence for 4 weeks in the U.S. Supreme Court. There is none. There are two cases that make reference to the Fourth Amendment. In the first 150 years or so, or whatever that works out to be, 120 years, because there was no benefit to bringing those motions. There was no exclusion of the evidence, so no one ever raised a Fourth Amendment issue. Now, if causation is the remedy, or is the criteria for a remedy in knock and announce violations, you're not going to hear about knock and announce violations again, I assure you, because no one's going to have any motive or reason to challenge them. But what you're also going to have is in every darn case, the cops are going to knock down the door. You know,
will or won't, considering whether there's more danger to them one way or the other.
The police are going to break down the door in every case, Your Honor. A dynamic entry. It's been suggested that a knock and announce violation, we've been talking about like it's somewhat rude, maybe, or a technical violation. Here's what a dynamic entry is. a group of people kick in your front door. They run into your house screaming, waving guns. They run into your bedroom, they put a gun in your face, put you down. They grab your wife, if you're a man, get her out of bed in her nightgown. They may sit her on a chair because they tend to be more polite to women, but not to your 12-year-old kid who, if he's a big strapping kid, they put the gun in his ear and they put him on the floor. Now, if this were done by private citizens, this is a big criminal outrage. There's not a judge in Wisconsin who wouldn't give the person who did that 50 years. But because they're the police, we call it a dynamic entry. Now, my point is, I think that's a fairly serious violation of somebody's rights, particularly in their home. And I don't think that it should be viewed as a technical violation.
Of course it's a violation if you enter and put people guns to their heads. But if you've got a valid search warrant and you have a right to get in, even if you knocked and announced, you could still put guns to the head, right?
You could. I think you're probably a little less likely to.
Well,
Diane,
no,
I concede.
It doesn't take very much to knock and announce, frankly. There's no limit about whether it's 2 seconds you got to wait or 10 minutes until they get into street clothes. You know
well,
that.
You do have to wait for a reasonable period of time.
Right. But the point of the matter is, all of these awful things that you say the police are doing have nothing to do whether they announced or not. It has to do with their concern that these people might have guns and otherwise hurt them, and that what they have to do is make sure that they are restrained until you can make sure that they don't have knives or guns. In other words, it's not causal that all of these awful things you describe have.
You mean whether they knock and announce?
That's right.
Is not going to, whether they decline to knock and announce to make a dynamic entry,
right,
is not going to depend upon whether you require them to knock and announce?
It has nothing to do with whether they put guns to your head.
Oh, all right. Just I won't argue with you, but I think it does. The fact of the matter is that a search warrant execution is very much a matter of adrenaline and fear. And the police are afraid any time they make a search warrant execution.
I think that's my point.
All right. No question about it. And where that fear is reasonable, that is where they have a reason to believe that they are in danger, if they knock and announce, the law says, hey, you can dispense with it. What I'm saying is that if you don't back up that rule, they're going to dispense with it in every case, period. And to suggest that, oh, you could sue them, you know, I don't know about the rest of the state, but I'll tell you, down in Racine, they're not breaking down a lot of front doors in Wind Point, where the people have lawyers, okay? They're kicking in doors where people don't have ready access to the court system or to civil legal remedies. For that matter, as the dissent pointed out in that Michigan case, which Mr. Kleinmeier sent to you a couple of weeks ago, none of the authorities ever relied upon in that case by the majority or by Mr. Kleinmeier has ever been able to cite a case where someone actually successfully brought a lawsuit for a rule of announcement violation. You know, if you go back to the federal jurisprudence, there's about a 40-year gap between Weeks and Mapp. And the reason for Mapp, as I understand the scholarly articles, is because in that 40 years, nobody ever developed an effective alternative to the rule of exclusion. For all that time, the Supreme Court declined to make exclusion mandatory upon the states. They kept saying, well, they'll find some alternative. And in Mapp, they said, it's been 40 years. You haven't found the alternative. Nobody ever found an alternative to exclusion that acted as an effective deterrent before Mapp, and nobody's come up with a suggestion since then. And the state, certainly in this case, has not come up with such a suggestion. Now, I feel that when we're discussing the cause argument, because I do think the cause argument's a real dangerous one, and I do think it eats the rule, but what the cause argument's going to do is going to create super Richards.
Super what?
Super Richards. That is, you had the rule of announcement could be dispensed with as a principled matter in a certain category of cases, drug cases, felony drug cases. And the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed with that. The response is you apply causation as the remedy. I'm sorry, you need causation in order to use exclusion as the remedy. And now we'll have no knock and announce rule, not just in the felony drug cases, but in any of the cases. Because if you don't have a penalty, you don't have a rule, as a practical matter, when you hit the ground with this thing. Now, Nix is relied upon, and Segura, as I understand, is relied upon, and a footnote in Ramirez is relied upon, and that is the doctrinal core of this causation argument. I see only one problem with it. I've read all three of those cases, and surely each of you is in a more scholarly position than I to make judgments on what those cases say, but it doesn't seem to me those cases say anything like what the Attorney General is urging them to say. In Segura, you have two searches. You've got the police coming, federal agents actually, and making an arrest, and in the course of the arrest, they enter into an apartment and they make observations. At the same time, and in a different location, a search warrant is being prepared based upon information they had before they made that entry. And the question presented is, given that completely factually separate search, do you have to suppress the results of the execution of the search warrant because when they entered, they violated the Fourth Amendment? The answer is, of course not. You have two separate searches there. Nix, you have two separate searches. You have one search, a general search, which is begun and is completely independent of anything else and which is inevitably going to discover this body. And you have the separate search as a result of the statement. Same situation. Ramirez, I'm reluctant to discuss just because it's a footnote and the facts aren't really important. But the point of that is that in causation, whenever causation has been discussed, whenever it's been said, well, this violation wasn't a cause, what they're really saying is not that the violation didn't cause the evidence to be seized, but that there was something else going on at the very moment that was going to cause the evidence to be seized. Now, in order to apply any of that precedent to this case, you'd have to have two separate searches. You don't have that in this case, you don't have that in the Reese case, and I don't think you have that in any knock-and-announce case. You can't surgically separate out the method of entry from the search itself. It's all of a piece. If it's an unreasonable search, it's an unreasonable search. So I think that the argument on causation has no doctrinal underpinnings. And, by the way, if you believe in deterrence, I think the state sort of argues from two different directions here. They argue Leon. Well, Leon's all based on the idea that the only basis for an exclusionary rule is deterrence. But then they argue causation. If you believe in causation as the basis for exclusion of evidence, then if you believe in deterrence as the basis for exclusion of evidence, then the causation argument makes no sense at all, because if all you want to do is deter the police, you want to exclude the evidence in any case of illegal conduct. Otherwise, you're teaching no lesson and having no impact.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
What about a very narrow good faith exception? The facts here involve officers who believe they are acting under, they're acting under a case from this court, and they were acting perfectly consistent with it. Or in some other case, you might have the police that know they are acting perfectly consistent with a statute, subsequently found, the statute either subsequently found to be unconstitutional or the case, as here, to be overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court. Why can't we say in those instances anyway, we're not going to exclude?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, because if you believe in the judicial integrity argument, maybe you don't, I don't know, but if you believe that there is a violation, a problem with a judge in a courtroom.
But there wasn't at the time. At that time, the law in Wisconsin, in every court in the state, was you don't have to knock and announce if you're dealing with a felony drug case.
Sure, but the suppression order was entered before the trial. Right? And all the suppression order says is, okay, now we know this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Therefore, as a judge, I am not going to accept this evidence in because Ms. Orta's rights were violated the Fourth Amendment was violated, Section 1, Article 11 was violated, Article 1, Section 11, sorry, was violated, and I am not going to be a party to that violation.
Well,
I mean, nobody's going back and doing anything terrible to the policeman here. There's no personal injury being inflicted upon him. What we're saying is a system. We recognize this now as a violation, and we are not going to further it, continue it, or be party to it.
So you're timing it as of the date of the suppression hearing. And that's the date you look at judicial integrity.
Well, absolutely. I think that's where you look at judicial integrity. If you talk about deterrence, sure, you're talking about at the time of the search. But no, I don't see anywhere in our state constitution where it says that the state is limited to being policemen. I think that the court's part of the state, and that the prosecutor's part of the state. And in fact, I think it demeans the system more if the courts are part of a Fourth Amendment violation or take advantage of it. And I think that's what you said in Hoyer, isn't it? I mean, there's no talk of deterrence in Hoyer. When you get into Hoyer, they talk about what constitutional principles mean and what our state constitution means and how we as judges aren't going to be a part of taking illegal evidence in as evidence. Now, that's one of the problems. That's one of the problems I would have with Leon, Your Honor. The other problem is that it seems to me that we already have a fair amount of doctrine that renders Leon useless or needless. You know, Leon, if you take Leon in this small group of cases, which you grant you have very strange facts or a very strange circumstance, but once, as a practical matter, this court says, oh yeah, we're going to apply good faith, you're going to hear about it in every single case that comes up. Because
well,
the
only search warrant cases.
Well, I don't know. Only search cases?
Search warrant cases.
Well?
Has it been extended beyond search warrant?
Well, yeah, Kroll was brought up. Kroll was a case where there was no search warrant because there was a statute. And you're going to hear about Leon in arrest cases because knock and announce, you know, applies to cases where there's an arrest being made with or without a warrant. I mean, once you introduce Leon into the jurisprudence of the state of Wisconsin, then I think you're on a slippery slope. I think you're going to hear about it every day. And why? Why would you want to? You've already got Gates. If you're dealing with search warrant cases, haven't you already got Gates that says if you have a warrant and you have an affidavit, we look at that affidavit not to determine. Whether it could be reasonably said that the magistrate had a basis for believing there was probable cause. Now, that's a lesser standard. Isn't that awfully close to what Leon already says? Because when you get into Leon, it says we won't excuse the search based on an affidavit if there was no basis in the affidavit. Now, why do you want to make that extra leap in order to protect a small group of cases? I grant you that in my case, the affidavit has absolutely no basis in it for the no-knock authorization. I may be speaking beyond the limits of my case. But just in terms of why you would want to adopt Leon, the costs of Leon are awfully high in terms of opening a can of worms. And can't you just turn to retroactivity analysis? I mean, yeah, the police relied upon a previous case from this state Supreme Court. But how reliable was that case? I mean, no disrespect to the state Supreme Court, but Stevens, which is what Blurred thinks, was only 3 years old. It had been challenged, and then Wilson had come down a year later, throwing Stevens into doubt. Then Richards came along, and I agree that in Richards, a year to 2 years later, you said Stevens is still good law. But conceding that, it has to be conceded that Richards was also appealed, accepted for cert by the United States Supreme Court, briefed and pending for decision at the time the affidavit and warrant in this case were issued, and at the time that it is said that the police were relying on Richards as being something they could rely on. Now, if the police are entitled to rely on the law, particularly on case law, then
they are only entitled to rely on it within the limits of that case law. Case law changes. That's why we already have the retroactivity analysis over under United States versus Johnson that specifically addresses case law. And as a matter of fact, I'm not aware of any case where Leon has been applied to say that the police can rely on case law, because case law is in flux. It is dynamic. You've got Kroll, oh sure, but Kroll talks about a statute. And you've got Leon itself, but Leon talks about affidavits and warrants. But as to case law, it's the nature of the of case law that it changes. If you look at Johnson, they have a good set of criteria in it. When are we retroactively going to apply a case? When are we going to prospectively apply a case? And they look at, is this case law widespread? Is this United States Supreme Court case law? Does this change a long-standing policy of the courts? And the answer is no, no, no in this case. I mean, there is no basis for the police to have relied upon the law of the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. Because the law, as stated, at least the Stevens precedent, was too new and too much in flux and was a big question of time.
Please stand in front of the microphone take you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I tend to do that.
What would be the situation, sir, if a statute authorized no-knock entries under certain circumstances?
Right now, it would be unconstitutional on its face. You mean that authorized it without the police officers having to have exigent circumstances?
Would the police be entitled to rely on such a statute? Your argument seems to be that the police and everybody else in society doesn't have a right to rely on the decisions of this court until they're either affirmed by the United States Supreme Court or they decline to review. That seems to be the logical extension of the argument. And the question is, you know, what if this was the statutory rule? Does that change your argument?
Yes, it's not the nature of statutes that they're subject to constant review and change. Statutes, in fact, tend to be sort of possessed of certain inertia. In addition, not to criticize in any way the statutory process, but the other thing about statutes, I guess, is that they're a process of, or they're arrived at by a different process, and they're reviewed in a different process.
Well, but suppose you had a statute that, on its face, was unconstitutional. That is, it said, under no every circumstance where you get a warrant, you can enter without knocking. Or you can get a statute that says if you have probable cause to enter a home, you can enter it without a warrant. Now that's, as I understand the law, unlawful, right? Because you need a warrant to get into a house, except under special circumstances. So suppose you had a statute that on its face, anyone that knew anything about search and seizure law would know that's unconstitutional. Can enter a house anytime, right?
Yes.
So, I think the question of the justice's Prosser insight is, can the police officer rely on that statute to enter the home and then, under federal law, not state law, seek the good faith exception? Or are you going to say, no, you're holding them to know that this is invalid law? It's not good faith. I mean, that's what Nansen says. But the question, at least for Justice Sykes, is.
Well, I think the answer to both parts of the question is no. That is, because I think the question proceeds in a way from a false premise. It's unconstitutional. I don't expect the policeman necessarily to know that it's unconstitutional, but I don't expect him to have the benefit of that ignorance. The fact of the matter is, I mean, the question is, when we get into court, not is the policeman going to be sent to jail for stealing the evidence because it was an invalid search. When we get into court, are we going to introduce that evidence or that item into evidence? The policeman doesn't do that. The judge does. You know, it was Justice Callow, no more than 7-8 years ago in Whitrock, who reaffirmed that deterrence of the policeman is not the only purpose of the exclusionary rule. Speaking for this court and that recently, he noted three reasons. He said it's to deter unreasonable searches, certainly, but also to maintain judicial integrity and to assure all potential victims of unlawful government conduct that the government will not profit from its lawless behavior. Now, I will grant you that if deterrence of police misconduct is the only reason that you have an exclusionary rule, then Leon might make some sense. I think there are problems with it, but it might make some sense. But if the receipt of the items into evidence is a matter of concern, if the violation of the substantive right of the individual is of concern, if those are also of concern to the court, if those are also factors that underlie the application of the exclusionary rule, then the good faith exception does not make any sense. Not in the case of the legislative enactment, not in the case of the precedent, even from a state's high court.
Yeah, but there's tension in the exclusionary rule on the judicial integrity argument across the board, because judicial integrity is also implicated when you keep out of evidence and you eliminate from the fact finder the possibility of hearing what is otherwise completely reliable and completely relevant evidence on account of police misconduct or police misinterpretation of the state of constitutional law. So that's a two-sided coin, is it not?
Yeah, but that's not the price you pay for the exclusionary rule, Justice. It's the price that you pay for Article 1, Section 11, and the guarantee against unreasonable searches. You know, when we talk about judicial integrity, I think we talk about something beyond the question of the reliability of the process, of the fact-finding process. We're talking about whether the system itself follows the rules. And I think it's been recognized way back to the Revolution that a lawless government is a lot more dangerous than a lawless individual. That's what I meant back at the beginning of the argument when I was talking about this being a Supreme Court. You know, you're going to make findings.
How do you have a lawless government if what's going on is the police are relying on decisions of the highest court of the state? I'm really having trouble following that.
Because the judge, at the time of admitting the evidence, knows that it violates the Constitution, doesn't he? I mean, isn't that the assumption?
Well, that's the argument you're making in your case, but that's obviously not the situation in every case. Why shouldn't we be focusing on the time of the action by the police?
If you focus on the time of the action by the police and what they knew at that time, first, I think you are shifting the judicial integrity argument out the window, but secondly, and I've always had this problem with the deterrence argument. Are you trying to teach the specific policeman in this specific instance what the law is and that he's supposed to comply with it? Or are you trying to teach all policemen in this kind of instance what they should be doing? Because I don't understand how the subjective knowledge of the particular policeman in this case, if he is innocent of wrongful intent, in any way cleanses the violation of the Constitution. And if you say it's fine in this case simply because of the peculiar circumstances of this case, what are you teaching the other policemen?
Well, you're now assuming that the no-knock rule is a constitutional rule rather than a judicially made rule in what you've just responded.
There's no question that the no-knock rule is a constitutional rule, sir.
Well, I think there's a real debate on that.
Well, it's part of the reasonableness test, counsel, under the Fourth Amendment. And if then you mean that's part of the Constitution, fine. But it might not be part of the Wisconsin Constitution.
The Wisconsin Constitution also contains a provision not contained in the United States Constitution that preserves the common law, doesn't it? I have citation.
So, but you're recognizing, and I think this is part of Justice Crooks's question, you're recognizing that maybe in Wisconsin this is part of the common law, that is the no-knock, rather than part of our Constitution.
Well, there's no question but that it's part of the common law, Justice. and our Constitution preserves the common law. But if I have understood Wilson... I'm sorry,
Mike. No, I see your argument.
Okay, if I understood Wilson, if I understand Richards, it's also part of the reasonableness inquiry. I mean, we've had no knock since before we even had a country, much less a Constitution. Thank you. I see the red light is glowing at me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nielsen. Mr. Kleinmeier, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd like to start off by trying to tie together a couple points made by counsel. One is he tried to distinguish the Segura and Nix cases, and they could probably distinguish on the facts. We're not relying on the facts, we're relying on the underlying principles in those cases. And he's saying that the state's argument is inconsistent and relying on cause, deterrence and good faith, but not deterrence when it comes to cost. First of all, in Segura and Williams, Segura says suppression is one of the underlying principles in Segura is suppression is not justified unless the challenged evidence is in some sense the product of illegal government activity. So there's the causation. In Nix, the court says, it is clear that the cases implementing the exclusionary rule begin with the premise that the challenged evidence is in some sense the product of illegal government activity. So you don't even get to the exclusionary rule in the issue of deterrence unless you first of all have cause. And that's why the Court of Appeals in State versus Stevens, we have too many Stevens cases. The Court of Appeals in the Stevens case, I think in the fall of 1997, I think it was in 213, Wisconsin second, there about. They agreed with the state that the evidence seized in the no-knock was not, there was no causal relationship between the evidence and the failure to announce. But they said, we're going to exclude it to deter the evidence, to deter misconduct, citing Mapp versus Ohio. The problem is, Mapp versus Ohio, there was the causal relationship. It was a warrantless entry. I mean, the cause is the first step before you can consider exclusionary rule and all the reasons for exclusionary rule, which are deterrence, judicial integrity, and anything else. So deterrence isn't even a factor until you first of all find the cause. I think Illinois, there was question, some discussion about the retroactivity. I think Illinois versus Crowell discussed that in the context of the statute in there. And it's hard for me to believe, I don't understand how a statute, how a police officer should be entitled to rely on a statute, find more reliability to statute defining constitutional law than the state Supreme Court's decision defining constitutional law. And apparently, before a police officer can rely on a state Supreme Court decision defining constitutional law, he has to wait for an indefinite period of years. By the way, the Stevens case was petitioned for cert, and cert was denied. So I realize that's not supposed to be a presidential value, but if the police officer is expected to follow the history of Supreme Court this court's decisions, if the police officer looks at that, sees the U.S. Supreme Court has decided Wilson versus Arkansas. After deciding Wilson versus Arkansas, denies cert in State versus Stevens, his common sense, street decision is going to be, gee, they must think it's okay. I mean, at that point, I don't think there's any reason for him to question it.
Now, counsel, if the court should find that there's no causation, no causal factor here, then it never has to get through the good faith, does it?
Correct, because it doesn't get the exclusionary rule.
So it's not excluded, therefore, and there's not a good faith issue.
Right.
But in the other case, it has to get to good faith because even if it finds probable cause, it would get into the no-knock. But in that case, was no-knock causal?
No, it would be the same. Our position is the same. It was not causal.
Okay. Thank you.
Actually, the court never gets to know if to the good faith if in the first case it finds the warrant was valid and that there's no causal connection, and in this case it finds there's no causal connection, it never reaches good faith in either one of them.
That's why you've emphasized in both cases that part of the case.
The causal part?
Yeah.
Yes, because I think that's the first step. You have to decide, first of all, whether the exclusionary rule applies before you get to whether you look to an exception to the exclusionary rule.
And your position in both cases is the exclusionary rule doesn't apply.
Right, because of the lack of causal connection. And Hoyer also, that had the causal connection because the police discovered the alcohol without the warrant and without any justification for it. Early in the discussion, there was a claim that made it sound like these arguments were aimed only at drug cases. This goes beyond drug cases. I mean, these are underlying basic principles for the exclusionary rule and good faith. They were applied to cases beyond drug cases. They could apply. So, I mean, the analysis would apply.
It would apply in theft cases if someone was stealing some television sets. You'd be able to go into the house
without announcing because television sets are sometimes held in houses. Or if someone was embezzling money, you'd be able to go in their house to check that. And if someone was selling unlawful securities, you'd be able to go into their house because records are normally kept in houses. Is that right?
Well, that goes to the first issue, apparently, in the first case. And I don't know if experience would justify those conclusions like it does in the drug case. I think I have to look at them as we go along. There was also saying that you should not surgically separate the... I was going to say there was arguments you cannot surgically separate the entry from the execution search warrant, but I think the court ended up in the Nola Probe case, which you cited, the idea of separating the search under the warrant, along with the search, exceeding the warrant. I mean, that's a similar type of analysis, I think, where the court has submitted one type of evidence and excluded another type.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Now, if the students will remain seated here, and anyone else who would like to participate is welcome to do so, retired Chief Justice Roland Day will talk to the students about the processes and procedures of the Supreme Court. Not necessarily, in fact, not about. Students will remain seated. Chief Justice Day will be in shortly. Everyone else may leave. We are in recess.